For these few weeks, we thought we might visit some offshore islands. You might get there yourself over your holidays. Last week, we made the journey across to the Great Blasket Island with Billy O'Connor on his rib. This week, Noel Sweeney walks around the Great Blasket and meets some of the people who'll be calling it home for summer 2020.
The first thing you see when you get to the Great Blasket Island is the deserted village that we've all seen in pictures. Walking through these ruins, it's hard not to imagine what the day-to-day life is like for the inhabitants. Blasket Island historian, Michal Demura.
The Blasket people, they had their good days and their bad days. And the weather, of course, affected everything. And there were lots of storms and things like that here. But they had one great sense of place and of community. And the community was way more important than the individual. Say, if somebody did something wrong that affected the community in an adverse way, they were actually put in their place, you know, by the community. They always helped each other, you know, and they were very neighbourly in that. And every house was everybody else's house, if you know what I mean. They were able to run freely into each other's houses, and there were no locks on any door or anything like that.
Just a few minutes into my visit, I notice a lady perched outside what looks like a refurbished cottage. Sue Rettison has been a part-time resident of the Great Blasket since 1987.
I do weaving and spinning and use the fleece, not from the sheep here. They're a Highland sheep, so they have an extra layer of hair, so it's very scratchy. Yeah. So I tend to use a Galway fleece or Jacob's fleece. They're much softer, and I do plant dyeing with some of them.
Is it from one of the Arryns, or is it from... So is it Arryn fleece done on the Blaskets, or is it West Galway somewhere?
Galway fleece, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it is, yeah. Cool. Yeah. Although I did get an alpaca from the Arryn Islands. Some woman sent me down an alpaca fleece, so that was interesting.
And where do you typically do your work?
Sit outside with the spinning wheel, if it's a fine day. Mm. If it's raining, inside.
You've been coming here since 1987, so it's obviously sustaining a lifestyle for you.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's very peaceful. I enjoy the quiet. And just to get away from the mainland, really. Dingle can be very busy in the summer.
So we're here outside this stone wall building here, and this is where you live?
This is where I live for the summer.
So, and how big is it roughly?
I'd say it's about 10 feet by 8 feet. Very thick walls though, so it is very warm. It's got a tarred roof, felt and tar, so if there's any bit of sun, that holds the heat as well.
Even in April, October, May, or May,
yeah.
September?
Yep, any bit of sun and it'll be nice and warm.
This was an old shed, was it, or something?
This was actually a cow shed. Yes, belonging to one of the other houses.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no water, no running water, no electricity. So everything seems to take much longer to do. You know, the islanders had a particularly hard life because if they were cooking, they were cooking on fire, an open fire. At least I've got gas, cylinders of gas to cook on. But, I mean, your whole day is spent really just existing. By the time you've boiled water for your breakfast, to wash your clothes, to have a wash, it's lunchtime nearly.
But I suppose in your case, you're not trying to beat any traffic, I suppose, in the mornings.
No, that's true. No traffic jams in here. No.
Sue isn't the only resident around the place. After a huge social media call-out, Annie Burney and Owen Boyle were selected from 42,000 applicants to run the island's hostel and coffee shop. They took some time out of their busy day to tell me all about their new adventure.
When I was younger, I'm from Waterford originally, so I'm from Kilmeaden in Waterford. And when when summer would come around, all my family, we would pile into a camper that we had, and we'd travel all around places like Dingle and Ventry and West Cork, and we played a bit of Irish music as well. So I suppose I kind of developed a real love of that whole part of Ireland. And when I was about 11 or 12, I read on Tillaunach, the Islander by Tomasa Crohan, and I was just bowled over by it. So I suppose I was kind of aware of the Blaskets, you know. I was out here when I was younger, and to be honest with you, myself and Owen, we didn't even ever dream that it would be that there was a position like this, that it could be a place that you could spend more than a day. And then we saw the lovely feed from the Great Blasket Islands account, Instagram and Twitter account. So Alice and Billy, but also Leslie and Gordon, who lived here last year. And I suppose that drew our attention to the role. We were seeing it almost every day. And I suppose it was one of those things that we were talking about it so much, it couldn't be coincidence. We were thinking about it and we kept coming back to it, no matter what our lives were doing up in Dublin.
What was your previous role?
So I was working in a place called Airfield Estate in Dundrum, which is kind of a big family farm area. And one of my main responsibilities there, they started a pilot project with a group called Walk, who do a lot of work with adults with disabilities. Yeah, it was nice. Now, I was outdoors all the time, you know, and I was, it's in a beautiful space, like, you know, so the outdoors hasn't been a big shock to me, you know. Most of my work in life has been outside in education or in other kind of tour guiding or jobs like that.
My roles before this would have been based in education, and I worked in the education department of the National Museum of Archaeology. So I would have been talking to people about, you know, the amazing cultural heritage of Ireland.
So are you in a kind of a quasi heaven here? So
yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible. And this, I suppose, to a certain extent is living history as well, you know. People get to come out, they get to experience the places, all these amazing little place names around the island, you know. And Tro Vaughan, like, is famous from a lot of the books of the Blaskets, so people can read these books but then they can come out and experience a little bit of it themselves.
We've all heard of Tomás O'Crohan and Peg Sayers and Mirza Sulawans, but the island was home to many writers, some of whom are only becoming known today.
Eilish Ní Hoolabhain, she emigrated to America, and she was Muirish O'Sullivan's, one of the main authors, his sister. She was his sister, you know. But before she left the island, she wrote a diary and kept kind of accounts of the young people leaving and that sort of thing. So she went on the emigrant's trail herself in the end, and finished up in Springfield. But she fell on hard times, and I think there was some drink involved. And the poor creature, you know, she didn't have a good life in America. And I'm sure she rued the day that she left the island. It's only recently, there is a scholar in UCC who is actually Neil Inchig. And she looked into her diaries and that sort of thing, and has written a couple of essays about that, you know. And I have a tract or two which was actually translated into English, which I can read.
I have been well amused since this morning, as my family were out gathering turf, and I was to head up to them with food at midday. I thought they'd have most of the turf gathered by then, and I didn't hurry, so that there mightn't be much left for me to help with. I set off for the hill with my donkey in front of me, the lunch satchel strapped across my back and a tin flask of tea in my hand. I looked ahead closely at the place on the hill where the turf was, but if I did, I saw no sign of any of it having been gathered. So I got closer. It seemed they were gathering stones and setting them as a base for the reek. "Lord bless us," said my wise father, "but we thought the day would be gone before you'd arrive." "And my word indeed," I said, "but I wouldn't come so soon, except I thought you'd have half the turf gathered up by now."
The Blasket Islanders were great musicians as well. And they had their songs and they had their fiddles and they used to have their dances. And, you know, of course, the young men used to flirt with the girls as well, you know. And it was a great time for the men and the women and everybody on the island were the summer months, because visitors used to come to the island and the great scholars, and they used to have dances. And I remember island men, you know, when they were out here, when they were old men, and they used to talk about how they were flirted with young girls from, and that, who were in there learning Irish, and they had their own girlfriends on the island, but they didn't bother with them in the summer.
They preferred the strangers, as they say, the stronchieri. And they were talking about sending the local girls, their regular girlfriends, out to an island beyond the great place. It's called Beginish, which was a small island, to corral them there for the summer, you know, while they might have their evil ways with the young girls from Dublin and other places.
Noel Sweeney with historian Michael De Morta and some of the residents of the Great Basket. The islands, of course, are synonymous with writing in Irish and writing about the sea. And the sea has often played a big part in the works of Irish writers, as our regular contributor Hugh Oram has found.
Irish writers often have a rather tenuous connection with the sea. Strange in a way when you consider that we are an island nation surrounded by the sea. But despite that on-off link with the sea that's so common in Irish life, a number of well-regarded Irish writers have made the sea an integral theme in their writings. When Flann O'Brien, also known as Brian O'Nolan, and Patrick Kavanagh made their pilgrimage to the James Joyce Tower just above the 40-foot bathing place in Dorky, County Dublin, to celebrate Bloomsday exactly 50 years after the day on which James Joyce had set his epic tale, O'Nolan went on to write lyrically about the Dorky coastline, especially along the Vico Road. O'Brien featured this particular stretch of coastline in one of his books, The Dorky Archive. He had the fictional scientist De Selby in conversation with St. Augustine in a hidden sea cave below the waterline. The Ulysses connections also run the entire length of the Dublin coastline. Molly Bloom first said yes among the wild rhododendrons above the Irish Sea, in the same place where Yeats had lived for 3 years, yet had failed to woo the affections of Maud Gonne. Going back a century, Irish language writers like Thomas O'Crohan and Peg Sayers, whose stories were written down and recorded as part of the National Folklore Collection at the time of the Gaelic Revival just over a century ago, lived on the Great Blasket Islands off the Kerry coast. They wrote about how the sea played a crucial role in the lives of the islanders of the time. They carried out mackerel and lobster fishing using light canoes, while seals and basking sharks were also hunted. The seal meat was eaten. It sounded most unappetizing. And the oil from the livers of sharks and seals was used to fuel lamps long before electricity came to the Western Isles. That literary connection with the sea has continued right up to the present day. In much more recent times, Iris Murdoch's novel The Sea, The Sea, and John Banville's novel, also with a strong sea theme, both won the Man Booker Prize, a substantial prize in the literary world. Yet this infatuation with the sea is no new phenomenon for Irish writers. Back in the 18th century, Jonathan Swift put many mentions of the sea in his book Gulliver's Travels. And also in the 18th century, Jonathan Swift had an obsession with the wild waters of Ireland, often going on holiday beside the Midland Lakes. And in much more recent times, Ireland's greatest ever poet, W.B. Yeats, wrote lovingly of the Lake Isle of Innisfree. That literary link with us continued more or less unabated right up to the present. The powerful draw of the sea was seen in much more recent times when Joseph O'Connor's book, The Star of the Sea, was published in 2004. It was set in famine times during the 19th century, aboard a famine ship sailing from Ireland to New York in 1847. It was a phenomenal success, selling an amazing 800,000 copies in just 1 year in the UK. And one of the big attractions of the sea for people in Ireland is that, according to novelist and short story writer Kevin Barry, the seaside is great for memories. Long hidden tales of childhood and other family memories are soon brought to the surface. And Barry recalls how W.B. Yeats would go and buy tinctures of cannabis from a chemist in Sligo. And when Yeats was stoned out of his mind, he was in the habit of rolling around the beach at midnight. Yet another contemporary writer, Kevin Curran, finds that swimming in the ocean gives you space to think. The horizon is unlimited, and it creates a wonderful sense of time and space. A whole new wave of young writers are coming along, and the chances are that some at least of them will be deeply influenced by the sea. In many ways, our love of the sea is a hidden discourse, something that's not often mentioned in everyday conversation. But the truth is that for most of us, a deep affection for the sea that surrounds us is buried far down in our minds. And when those emotions are revealed, very, very deep thoughts come to the surface, matching the very depths of the sea.
Hugh Oram. Now, a couple of months ago, we spoke on the programme to Marine Institute scientist Vera Quinlan. She'd been at sea for a year. She set sail with her husband, Peter Owens, and their two children, Lillian and Rory, on their steel yacht, Danu of Galway. They went across the Atlantic to Caribbean and now have just arrived back. Last weekend, they arrived into the Iron Islands and then onto Galway for a warm welcome. Lorna Siggins spoke to Vera after a bumpy ride from the Azores.
So yeah, we just arrived into Kilronan last night after our Atlantic passage from the Azores up to, into Kilronan and the Arran's. And that's myself, Vera, Peter, my husband, and our two wonderful children, Lillian, who's 12, and Rory, who is 10. It was 10 days from the Azores. Normally you would head north a little bit to get out of the Azores High, and then we caught some fantastic winds, southerly winds for 4 or 5 days, and all was going pretty good. Lots of sailing, lots of nice fast sailing, all reaches or beam reaches, all the way up to 50 degrees north. And that's, I guess, where you start seeing all the depressions coming in at you, and you're trying to weave your way in and out of the depressions. So we thought we could catch this northerly front from one of the depressions in towards Arran, and we ended up with 35 knots heading us. So that wasn't really happening. And so the sail was reduced more and more and more until eventually we looked at each other and we said, this isn't happening anymore. And the wind is screaming and you're trying to, shouting to communicate to each other, and the waves are getting bigger. So we said, OK, this is hove to territory. Hoving to is a position you put a boat into. You point her slightly up into the weather, and she'll take the waves and the weather much better. You're not trying to go forward or force the boat through any of this weather. And so what you can do is you leave her in this position. You put the tiller hard over and she goes up to wind. You take your sails down. You might have a small mizzen or a little bit of mainsail, and she stays there relatively comfortable. And you can close up the hatches and everybody's down safe below. So that's where we stayed for 10 hours while these conditions passed over us. And it was during the night, so we were 10 hours there overnight. I have to admit, I didn't sleep too much. The kids slept through the whole thing, which was great. We had a couple of growlers. I think they call them growlers in the Southern Ocean. I don't know if I can call them growlers here in the North Atlantic, but all I can say is that they were blooming big, and I was very glad we were in deep water. We were off the continental shelf. We were about almost 400 miles out when we were in these conditions. It's essentially like a huge wall of water coming towards you and breaking onto the boat, and the boat heels right over, her rails go under, and then she pops back up and it's fine. And we only got two of these in 10 hours, and she took them absolutely. The boat is absolutely, boat is happy out. It's just sometimes my heart flutters a little, but there you go. That's North Atlantic sailing for you. So it reduced to under 30 knots, and we start sailing again up towards Ireland. And we were in between two systems and trying to get in again. There was another system. As we know, the west coast of Ireland has these systems rolling in the whole time. So it was just six touching seven, but unfortunately there was a lot of east in it. But we got blown off our waypoint. We were trying to make Gregory Sound, but we made the northwest tip of Arran there, the west tip, just around Rock Island. We had a lovely welcome here from two boats from Kinvara, Palades, which is my father's boat, and his wife Kay, my father Fergus and Kay, and the Minogue family, Conor and Breda, and their two sons, Moss and Micheál, both sailing families from Kinvara. And that was lovely. They had champagne and banners, and so we kind of felt very special. It was really nice to come in and take a deep breath.
So Vera, I know that Lillian and Rory are cycling around Inishmore now with Peter, but they've had wonderful adventures, starting with that walking in the Picos in Spain and then trekking across the Atlas Mountains for 7 days to the Sahara so that they could have a ride on camels, and then visiting the Canaries and that little piece of Africa in the Cape Verde Islands. And it's been a wonderful education for them.
A lot of people ask about homeschooling. And so, yes, we did do a little bit of homeschooling. I can put my hand up and say we certainly did not cover the school curriculum. But then who did this year? So
yes.
That kind of worked out.
Yes.
But we had decided we'll do diary writing, keep the writing up. I talked to all our teachers. They're so supportive. The kids go to Educate Together in Kilcolgan. They're absolutely fantastic teachers. And one thing that we did then was a science project. I work at the Marine Institute, and so we carried the whole way down, we carried, I suppose, what I can describe as a torpedo, a 2-meter torpedo, which is called an Argo float. And so we brought it into the school before we left Ireland, and had all the kids in the school, in the two classes that Lillian and Rory are in, to design the Argo float. And we were going to deploy the Argo float mid-Atlantic to involve the kids of the school in this science project. And so what does the Argo float do? It essentially goes down to 2,000 metres, and this records temperature and salinity. And so all this data is now being uploaded every 10 hours to the Marine Institute. It's still live, and it will be live for 4 years. And all that data will aid climate change. And one of the highlights, again, of the trip was navigating that Amazon tributary. So what we did is we entered French Guiana, went up the Moroni River. We navigated through these channels to get up there, with the trees, the rainforest coming in on top of you. The bird life was just incredible. The noise of the birds and the frogs and the insects at night, just unbelievable experience. And there is an Amerindian village that we knew along the way, and we were invited into the village. So that was incredible. And we also visited the space station there, the European Space Station, and saw a rocket launch. So that was another pretty cool highlight. And I suppose we're both scientists, both myself and Peter. So I suppose we lean towards the science and everything. So from French Guiana, we'd gone up through the Caribbean chain, and we had heard, obviously, rumours about China and COVID and all of that. And it affected a lot of yachts very badly. And I had a call from my sister in France, and she said, we have been given 12 hours to leave back to, you know, Ireland, UK, or we're going to be locked down in France for what we think could be 2 or 3 weeks. That was at the time. So the French closed down everything first, and I knew the other islands would follow. So I took... So we made decisions based on that. We wanted to try and make the best of this. So we said Barbuda. Barbuda is 30 miles to the north of Antigua. It's still under Antigua jurisdiction. We can go there. And we went to Barbuda, put our anchor down, and stay there for 5 weeks. And they couldn't have been nicer.
Vera, you and your crew had more challenges en route from Barbuda to the Azores. You had to ration your water, and you had to get diesel from a passing ship. And then you were 5 weeks in the Azores before heading home. What's it like to be back in these latitudes?
We've been away for 14 months on this Atlantic circuit. We left in quite feisty conditions. In fact, I so remember vividly the day leaving Parkmore Pier and friends from the Marine Institute waving from the balcony. And it was cold. We had all our weather gear. That was June 14th. And then we veered off then down towards Loophead, and we were heading for Dingle. And of course, at Loophead, the southerly came in sooner than expected. And we battled and we battled and we battled to get into Dingle. And you one would wonder why we sailed these latitudes at all for 14 months. I mean, literally, as soon as we got south of the Scillies, we've had fair winds behind us, blue skies. I mean, you wouldn't believe the sailing. It is, trade wind sailing is incredible. Yes, it's can be a little bit feisty. It can, you know, you're sometimes sailing in 30 knots, but it's always behind you or on your aft quarter, and it's just incredible.
And welcome home to Vera Quinlan and Danu of Galway.